I have given my lecture the title, Hindus and Christians, Celebrating Friendship and Facing Challenges with Hope. The order is significant. Although the differences between our two traditions, doctrinal differences as well as other differences, must not be minimized or overlooked, and our challenges must be identified and confronted, we ought not to forget the long history of friendship between Hindus and Christians and the relationships of mutual enrichment and learning that deserve to be honored and celebrated. Friendship and not hostility is still the norm of our relationship. To ignore or forget this is to be unfaithful to our relationship and to deprive us of a precious memory that inspires and offers hope for our common future. The fact is that Hindus and Christians have lived as friends and neighbors on the Indian subcontinent for centuries. Hindus also live peacefully as minorities among Christians in many parts of our world, across the United Kingdom, Asia, Africa, Europe, North America, the Caribbean, and Australia. At the heart of this Hindu-Christian friendship, on the Hindu side, I may venture to say, is a profound attraction for Jesus of Nazareth and for those who follow his path through discipleship. Quite early, many Hindus made the difficult and I would say problematic effort to distinguish Jesus from the institution of the church and its doctrines. And this is an effort, if I may add, with which many Christians are not unfamiliar. Hindus felt that the meaning of Jesus could not be limited to the institutions that represent him or the doctrines that sought to explain his significance. Ram Mohan Roy, I think he would be the first Hindu to attempt a systematic study of Christianity. He confessed his immense difficulty, and I quote, "Amidst the various doctrines I found insisted upon in the writings of Christian authors and in the conversation of those teachers of Christianity with whom I had the honor of holding communication," end of quote. In 1820, this is the first published work on Christianity by a Hindu. In 1820, Ram Mohan Roy published a small work entitled The Precepts of Jesus, The Guide to Peace and Happiness. This was a compilation of Roy's choice of the essential teachings of Jesus. Interestingly, he omitted the historical narratives and all references to the miraculous. Roy felt that the historical material was subject to doubt and the miraculous unlikely to capture the imagination of the Hindu reader. In other words, there were too many fantastic stories in Hindu mythology for this to be attractive. But his selection, he hoped, would have, and I quote, "the desirable effect of improving the hearts and minds of men of different religious persuasions and degrees of understanding," end of quote. Swami Vivekananda, one of the most influential teachers in recent times and the first to teach Hinduism systematically in the West, made a very special appeal for attentiveness to the teachings of Jesus. In his introduction to the Bengali translation of a work known as The Imitation of Christ, Vivekananda started by cautioning his fellow Hindus not to belittle this text because the author is a Christian. This medieval Christian work, which is popularly attributed to Thomas Kempis, fascinated him. And it was the only text that he traveled with throughout India after the death, along with the Bhagavad Gita, after the death of his beloved teacher, Sri Ramakrishna. Vivekananda also read the story of Jesus for inspiration on the occasion of the inauguration of the Ramakrishna Mission, one of modern Hinduism's most important service missions. And years later, of course, Mohandas Gandhi also sought the heart of Christianity, and he found it, he thought, in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, and wrote that these words went straight to my heart. Ram Mohan Roy, Swami Vivekananda, and Mohandas Gandhi, we must note, were commending Jesus and his teachings in a historical context where Christianity was virtually inseparable from colonialism, and in which missionaries denounced Hinduism as superstitious, idolatrous, and polytheistic. And what I find to be profoundly significant is that these negative, institutionalized Christian response to Hinduism did not elicit a similar rejoinder from these Hindus. All three, and many others, were speaking from a Hindu perspective in which commitment to a specific understanding of God did not rule out openness to and learning from other ways of understanding, or as we say in the Hindu tradition, other darshanas, other ways of seeing. They were faithful Hindus in not limiting God's revelation and experience to Hindu sacred texts, Hindu places of worship, and community. There is a deeply held insight in the Hindu tradition that divine self-disclosure adapts itself to the diversity of human understanding. As Sri Krishna puts it in the Bhagavad Gita, the paths people take from every side are mine. Mama varpanu vartante manushya partha sarvashah. Hindus have noted the similarity with Hinduism in the symbols and images, the examples and the parables used by Jesus in speaking about the religious life. They commend his freedom from greed, his non-possessiveness, his generous self-giving. Hindus have always understood renunciation as a fundamental expression of the genuine religious life, and the Hindu respect for Jesus is not at all surprising. In fact, Swami Vivekananda advised his Christian listeners in the United States that they should be ready to live in rags with Christ than live in palaces without him. I venture to say that the Hindu response to Jesus is exceptional historically. No central figure in one religion has been commended with such enthusiasm by seminal figures in another religious tradition. The Hindu understanding and enthusiasm for Jesus as a teacher and as an exemplar of the religious life differ, and we must note this, differ in significant ways from the mainstream Christian theological claims about Jesus' significance. And Hindus must acknowledge and not reduce these differences to semantics. Christians are often frustrated by what they perceive to be a scant regard among Hindus for differences of doctrine. The famous Rig Veda text, Ekam Sat Vipraha Bahuda Vadanti, the one being, the wise called by many names, articulates an important Hindu teaching that the oneness of God is not compromised by the many human ways of speaking. The purpose of this text is to help us know persons of other traditions, not as strangers with alien, false, or rival deities, but as fellow beings whose God is our God. This powerful text, however, is used, I would say, too often in dialogue to minimize the significance of differences within and among religions and to explain away these as entirely inconsequential. I think this we must avoid. Having said this, I must also add that a theocentric or a God-centered tradition like Hinduism is too often dismissed by those advocating the necessity for faith in Jesus as an exclusive savior. Jesus is used to minimize the value of the understanding and experience of God in Hinduism. Jesus-centeredness is made a litmus test of religious authenticity. Representing Jesus in a manner that is dismissive of Hinduism not only overlooks the unique Hindu embrace of Jesus, but makes it more difficult for us to be challenged and enriched by what his life and death teaches us about the nature of God and the meaning of human existence. The face of Jesus will be identified with those who triumphantly denounce Hinduism in his name, and this face will not be an attractive or inviting one. The time has come for us to acknowledge our differences in understanding Jesus' identity. Take note that there is a distinctive Hindu Christology or Christologies. Learn in humility from each other and deepen the friendship that our mutual interest in him and our appreciation of his significance make possible. Good relationships do not require the sameness of vision or the abandonment of distinctive self-understanding. The beauty of a good relationship is often found in the encounter, in the creative encounter of difference. Our relationship as Hindus and Christians require, like any good relationship, attentive nurturing and nourishment. We must not be indifferent or take it for granted. I wish to turn now to one of the principal sources of contemporary tension and contention in our relationship. This is the debate in India and elsewhere, centered on the issue of conversion and evangelization. On the Hindu side, we hear repeated calls for the enactment of laws to prohibit conversion from one religion to another. And in some cases, we have seen the implementation of legislation. In 2006, for example, the Rajasthan Assembly passed the Rajasthan Dharma Swatantraya Bill, stating, and I quote, "No person shall convert or attempt to convert directly or otherwise any person from one religion to another by the use of force or by allurement or by any fraudulent means, nor shall any person abet such conversion," end of quote. Although this bill and others like it do not make the act of converting from one religion to another illegal, the problem is that consensus on the meaning of terms like force, allurement, fraudulent is problematic, if not impossible. Many of the responses on the Christian side present the issue as one of religious freedom and urge and argue for the liberty of religious choice and the right to convert. And like proverbial ships in the night, passing each other without argument, these representative positions seem to provide no common basis from which the issue can be satisfactorily addressed. Conversion is a prime example, I want to say tonight, of a challenge that I think we can face together with hope. Although conversion from one religion to another is a very complex phenomenon and often inseparable from the socio-political realities of the local context, what is widespread is the despising of the convert. The reasons for the depth of hostility directed to the convert are many, and include the convert's attitude to the religious community that is left behind in the choice of a new one. And I think on this issue, we all have to engage in very deep self-critical reflection. At a fundamental level, the convert disturbs us and unsettles us, and our discomfort finds expression in antagonism. in Antipathy. The act of embracing a different religious tradition sharply challenges our settled assumptions about the adequacy of our own worldview. Conversion disturbs us by holding out the possibility that our answers are not the only ones or the only satisfactory ones. We see the act of conversion as one of primal rejection. And because our tradition so deeply defines our identity, we see it as an act of disloyalty to our community. And so our response is accusatory. We characterize the convert as a childlike, an immature individual who is incapable of exercising choice and judgment. We prefer to think that the convert does not cross religious boundaries because of any legitimate dissatisfaction with inherited tradition or anything of intrinsic worth in the other. It is less challenging for us to think of the act of conversion as a consequence of coercion or material inducement, and not as suggesting anything problematic in our tradition or attractive in the other. Many of us who are hostile to the convert do so from positions of power and privilege within our traditions. Since we experience our traditions as good for us, we assume that it is similarly good for all who are born into it. Through circumstances of birth and opportunity, we live in our traditions without ever experiencing oppression or violence that demean or negate our dignity and self-worth. We do not see how what may be good for us may not be good for others whose experiences within our faith may be quite different. It is instructive, and it has to be instructive for us, that the largest numbers of converts from the Hindu tradition to Buddhism and to Christianity come from the so-called untouchable castes. Yet, Hindu responses to conversion rarely demonstrate any self-critical reflection on the significance of this fact and what it means for us. On the other side of the pitya, the convert is welcomed and celebrated in his adopted religion. The winning of converts is represented as confirmation of religious claims to superiority and justification of arguments for the false or incomplete teachings of other traditions. The convert is championed as the insider who reveals authoritatively the unworthiness of the religious tradition that he has abandoned. He is used as an expert witness in the case made out against his community, and in doing so, reinforces his ostracism and his alienation. The convert too often becomes a pawn in a power struggle between our traditions. Most of the religious traditions of our world, of course, including Christianity and Hinduism, share the conviction that their teachings and practices are beneficial to human beings. This is common. We will not be committed to a particular tradition if we didn't think that its teachings are somehow beneficial, not only to us, but to humanity. This conviction expresses itself in a desire and willingness to share these with others, even though traditions have adopted historically different methods for such dissemination of their teachings. Hindu traditions are not unfamiliar with the religious motive of sharing one's conviction and persuading others about its validity. To claim otherwise is not to be faithful to important strands of Hinduism. In the Bhagavad Gita, for example, towards the conclusion of the text, Sri Krishna speaks of sharing his teachings with others as a priceless service. Narcha mam tasman manushyeshu kaschin me priya kritama. At the same time, the traditions of India evolved a certain ethos that that guided the nature of their relationships. The absence of institutionalization and centralization meant that there were no organized or systematic efforts to supplant or replace different viewpoints. Discussions among traditions were, on the whole, dialogical and would even result in conversion to the other's viewpoint if the other is persuaded. Persons with different religious commitments belonged to the same larger religio-cultural community where boundaries were flexible and permeable. There was and is no negativization of the fact of religious diversity in Hinduism. This diversity is seen as a natural reflection of the diversity of human nature and experience. There is also a widely shared understanding in the larger Hindu tradition of the limits of human reason and symbols. And this resulted in an agreement that truth always exceeded the comprehension and description of one tradition, and so justified relationships of humility towards people of different religious commitments. As we reflect on the historical entry of Christianity into this religious ethos, we must be cognizant of both the antiquity and diversity of Christianity. The Christian tradition in India has a very long history. The Eastern Orthodox churches, for example, trace their arrival to the first century and have a history in India that is not connected to colonial enterprise. We must also be careful not to casually equate colonialism and Christianity. Christian friends remind me that their encounter with the tradition was through fellow Indians and not Western missionaries. Yet, it is also true that Christianity made an impact on Hinduism as a carriage in the train of Western colonialism. It became associated in reality and in the minds of Hindus with imperialism and with the arrogance and disdain of the colonizer for Hinduism. This association lingers and continues to inform and influence Hindu attitudes to Christianity. Imperialist political claims were seen as finding echo in exclusive theological claims to revelation and salvation. Christian theology in relation to Hinduism was mission-oriented. The identification during the colonial period between Christianity and culture of the West resulted in the experience of these as inseparable. This identity between religion and culture, along with the fear that converts may revert to ancestral practices, led to systematic efforts to define a Christian identity over and against the prevailing Hindu ones. For example, Christian converts took on new names from the biblical texts, renamed villages to reflect their new faith, constructed churches following the architectural models of Europe, and adopted new musical forms. In many cases, converts adopted new forms of dress and cuisine. Such forms of self-definition help a community, especially a minority one, to maintain a new identity. At the same time, such deliberately sharp distinctions between self and other are a source of tension and resentment. This is especially so when the basis of such distinction is the claim also of religious superiority, and when the other, in this case the Hindu, is seen as fallen and in need of religious rescue. The nature of the Christian church as a voluntary association with membership implied and necessitated boundaries, and also reinforced the distinctions about which I am speaking. This significant dimension of identity, and we often forget that membership in a religious organization is something very new for Hindus. Only in the Western world are we having temples with lists of members. This idea of a voluntary association of membership is something that is quite characteristic of Christianity, but very new for Hindus. So the very idea of becoming a member of a church meant that I was now drawing a boundary around myself, which separated me now from the rest of the community, and so reinforced alienation and ostracism. So you had colonialism, exclusive theology, identification with and adoption of missionary culture, and voluntary membership in a new community, which separated the convert from the larger community and intensified fear, suspicion, and resentment. I think it is important that Christians take seriously the legitimate Hindu concerns about conversion, and especially the fear, I would call it a fear about a Christian program for world religious conquest and domination. Although some of the long-established Christian churches in India have made theological and cultural efforts to address some of these tensions between our two traditions, the fruits of these efforts are not well known among both Hindus and Christians. It is also true that many of the newer Christian missions are still militant in orientation and aggressive towards Hinduism. The consequence is, in spite of progress by some of the well-established mainline churches, and I want to acknowledge that kind of progress, in spite of this, Hindus continue to imagine and experience Christianity, and imagining is also a very important part of how we see reality, as an exclusive religion that is not open to the religious claims and experiences of others, and which is concerned primarily with increasing its institutional power and domination through conversion. Such perceptions, and in many cases they are perceptions, induce uneasiness, resentment, and defensiveness. We must admit the difficulty of building relationships when one assumes that in the eyes of the other, one's convictions are false and without salvific value. Hindus have the perception that mission is the most important concern of Christianity, and they are not generally aware of the internal theological diversity of the Christian tradition and current debates within Christianity about the meaning of mission. I think that many Hindus will be surprised to discover voices of support within Christianity for their concerns with conversion and proselytization. Clearly, Hindus and Christians need to come together in dialogue on this divisive issue. Such dialogue will help us to discover the areas of our mutual agreement and clarify our concerns. We will agree immediately, I think, as Hindus and Christians, that religious faith is meaningful only when it is freely chosen. No tradition is served if converts are gained through unethical methods of coercion, through the promise of economic or political rewards, or through misrepresentation of oneself or the other. Human vulnerability in times of material and emotional need must not be exploited for the purpose of gaining converts. Our two traditions commend generosity as an end in itself and as an outpouring of love and compassion that is free from the expectation of reward. This is something we share. The highest gifts in Hinduism are those that are given for the sake of giving without expectation of return. Dātavyam iti yad dānam dīyate anupakārine Bhagavad Gita. We Hindus must also recognize that conversion is not always the consequence of aggressive proselytization and inducement. Converts may be attracted to the worldview of another tradition. Some may be seeking an affirmation of their dignity and worth as human beings that they find promise and articulated in another tradition. The freedom to engage in religious inquiry and choice honored in Hinduism must not be compromised. I want to add also that the dependence on the state as an arbiter among religions in the matter of conversion is a sad concession of our own failure to find a mutually acceptable way forward. The empowerment of the state to intervene in matters of religious relationships will, I believe, work eventually to the detriment of both of our traditions. This is an issue that we should address without summoning the power of the state as an arbiter, as I believe we will all lose out. The state will want to encroach in the realm that truly belongs to religious traditions and the freedom of exercising choice. Our dialogue of hope must include also a conversation on the caste system. There are many Christians who see the Hindu concern with conversion as a disguised effort to preserve the privileges and power relationships inherent in the caste system. Such a perception, like the perception of Christianity with conversion, reflects a monolithic view of the Hindu tradition and ignores the controversial nature of the caste structure in Hinduism and the continuing history of challenge to the system by reform-minded Hindus and movements. It also ignores the fact that even the Christian church in India has not been able to free itself entirely from the social inequities and the expressions of caste. What do we share here? There is a theological vision at the heart of both Hinduism and Christianity that invalidates assumptions of inequality, impurity, and indignity that are at the foundations of caste belief and practice. This must be recognized, this must be affirmed by us both. The foundation of this vision is the Hindu teaching that God exists equally in all beings. Samam sarveshu bhuteshu tishtantam parameshwaram. When the implications for human relationships are enunciated, they are done in terms of equality. Hindu teachers throughout the ages, like Tiruvalluvar in the 2nd century, Tirumular in the 6th century, Basaveshwara in the 12th century, Ramananda in the 15th century, Kabir in the 16th century, Eknath, right down to the present period, were inspired by this vision of the equal and identical existence of the divine in all beings and spoke of human equality and dignity before God. This is something we share, and this is where our affirmation must be as Hindus and Christians. While some are able to escape the oppression of caste through conversion, I think that greater good and change for many more may be achieved by the mutual support and the transforming influence that the example of one religion may have on another. Such influence depends on developing a relationship of trust. Trust provides the secure ground on which we can stand to be self-critical in the presence of people of our own and other traditions. It is the soil in which truth can flourish and where different questions that we want to address and ask of each other can be raised. It is our best hope for mutual understanding and transformation. Christians must understand the complexity of Hinduism, and in particular, the contested nature of caste and the chorus of voices, as I said, ancient and modern, protesting the practice of caste as a betrayal of Hinduism's highest teachings about human existence. Hope and trust also enable us to be challenged and enriched by each other's understanding of the meaning of liberation. And here I think, this is where I think dialogue can help us to clarify each other's perspective. For example, traditionally, the Hindu quest for liberation, moksha, occurred after a life of success in the world. The path to liberation was associated with renunciation and disinterest in the world. In those forms of Christianity, on the other hand, that emphasize the role of Jesus as social prophet and his criticism of systems of domination, liberation is construed not only as overcoming estrangement from God, but also as liberation from systems of domination and the creation of a just and inclusive social order. Activity directed towards this end, such as provision of education, healthcare, housing, etc., are seen from the Hindu side as inducements to conversion and by Christians as an expression of the meaning of their commitment. Where do we agree? Hindus and Christians agree on the necessity for working to overcome human suffering. And this controversial matter offers us a wonderful opportunity for joining together in bringing relief to the poor and dispossessed and in overcoming injustice. We both need a more comprehensive understanding of the sources of human suffering and of our joint roles in the midst of injustice and oppression. I have highlighted some of the salient issues of concern that underline the necessity for continuing dialogue and action between our traditions. Some of these issues have greater significance in particular geographical locations. Today, one of the very important historical developments in the Hindu tradition is the establishment of communities in various parts of our world. In these societies, Hindus wish to participate fully in the lives of their new homelands while preserving a distinctive religious identity. Although our interconnected world makes it difficult and dangerous to ignore what happens elsewhere, we also need to ensure, as Hindus and Christians, that our relationships in our own communities are not dictated and controlled by what transpires in India or elsewhere. We have a particular history that we need to honor and we need to affirm. As Hindus, we need to be alert to the implications and dangers of popular movements and ideologies that narrowly equate the Hindu tradition with the nation state or with a single culture. Ideologies of this kind undermine the ability of a tradition to make truth claims that are universal in nature and relevance. Our status as minorities in many parts of the world has sensitized us to the problems of defining national identity in ways that do not accommodate diverse religious and cultural identities. And we must always be careful that we do not uncritically give our support to any form of majority rule that does not accommodate diverse religious identities. We serve our traditions best, not only through support, but also by offering constructive criticism derived from our distinctive Hindu experiences in various parts of the world. And our experiences today are diverse, and they ought to be brought into the table of enriching intra-Hindu discussion. Let me conclude with a word of hope, looking to the future. I think that we can look to the future and we can look to our challenges with hope. As I said at the beginning, violence and animosity toward each other in the name of our respective traditions are rare and can easily be averted by preventative measures at the local level. I referred at the beginning of my lecture to the historical friendship between our traditions. We must not overlook or take for granted the precious theological insights that we share and affirm. And I want to emphasize that I think this should be at the heart of our friendship, at the heart of our relationship. At the center of these theological insights is our understanding as Hindus and Christians that the meaning of our lives is inseparable from our belief that the universe has its origin in the intentional creative act of a loving God. In the Hindu tradition, of course, we refer to God as Ishvara or Bhagavan. The Upanishads define God in a way that I think all my Christian friends will agree. And the definition is that from which all have come, in which all exist, by which all are sustained, and to which all return. Yato va imani bhutani jayanti, yena jatani jivanti, yat prayanti avisambhishanti. We agree that in the light of God's infinite reality, our finite human words, our finite theologies and symbols must be incomplete. They will always fall short. Again, the Upanishads remind us that God is the one. This is another definition. God is the one from which all words, along with the mind, return, having failed to define. Yato vacho nivartante aprapya manasasa. A God whose nature and essence could be fully revealed in our words, or who could be contained within the boundaries of our minds and our traditions, would not be the God proclaimed either in Hinduism or in Christianity. Our confession of the limits of our human understanding before God is a powerful justification for a relationship between us of humility, of respect, of mutual learning and sharing. We share also a value for the dignity and equal worth of every human being, derived from life having its source in God, who is both immanent and transcendent. The Bhagavad Gita, which I quoted so many times, tells us that God exists in the heart of all beings. Ishvara sarva bhutana hrit deshe arjuna tishtati. The value of the human being is derived from embodying God, who has ultimate value. We agree that our knowledge of God is not meaningful unless it finds expression in a compassionate way of being and in labor to overcome suffering. We profess and express our value and commitment to God by our love and value for all in which God has entered and is present. Our reverence for life that has its origin in God is the source of our loyalty to the shared value of non-injury or ahimsa, a cardinal ethical principle in our two traditions. As a Hindu theologian, I confess to you my own sadness at the absence of sustained theological engagement between our two traditions. The reasons are complex and many, and beyond the scope of my words today, but I must make a plea for such theological dialogue. In the popular imagination, theology is unfortunately associated with a form of intellectual activity that is irrelevant to the religious life, and there are anti-intellectual currents in both of our traditions that lead to disinterest in theology and distinguish it from spirituality. In many contemporary Hindu movements, there is greater interest in the political and less in religious reflection and religious learning. In calling for renewed theological engagement, I have in mind the rich history of rational and scholarly reflection by persons of deep religious commitment in our two traditions. We need this. We need the mutual learning and enrichment that certainly comes from sharing the profound reflections of our traditions on the nature of God, the problem of human suffering and liberation. At heart, our traditions provide us with an understanding of the meaning of our existence. And our value for each other must be reflected in our effort to understand the other's meaning and share our own. I think if we lose sight of this, if we lose sight of what makes us and what defines us as religious people, and if this understanding is not at the heart of our relationship, then there is very little for us to come together for. For me, it is the reality of God that is the most exciting thing about being religious. And it is this that draws me to my brothers and sisters in other religious traditions. Theological sharing will help us to go beyond tolerance and towards active efforts at understanding. We need relationships that enable us to listen and to share, to ask questions and to be questioned. We need relationships that inspire cooperative action to overcome unjust and oppressive structures of all kinds, and that work to heal and transform our communities through the practice of justice. In a world that yearns for peace among religions, may Hindus and Christians, friends for centuries, lead the way. I thank you very much.
We've been very privileged indeed to hear a lecture of great depth and great scope, and a lecture which has not shied away from some of the most difficult questions that are among us and between us. And for that alone, I think we should be grateful. This has been a lecture of great honesty and great perception, challenging, quite rightly, everybody in the room, Christians and Hindus and others alike. And that's been a great privilege.